Pop quiz. What is 0.8% of the entire global economy? Don't worry, we're pretty good at math around here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, October 15th. Good to have you with us. New data on the cost of the U.S. and China trade war. The International Monetary Fund released a report today. It says global growth would get a 0.8% boost if China and the U.S. dropped the various tariffs they have imposed on each other since 2018. Now, less than 1% doesn't sound like a whole lot, but on the global scale, Marketplace's Andy Euler does some quick math.
Okay, when we say 0.8% of the global economy, how many dollars are we talking about?
That's, you know, like $800 billion.
That's Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says it also translates to adding an extra 22 million jobs worldwide.
It means adding to the world economy about as much as the Mexican economy is worth today.
Mexico's economy is the 15th largest in the world. The IMF is anticipating that global growth will fall to its slowest rate since the financial crisis. And the head of the IMF, Geeta Gopinath, called on politicians to do more to rein in geopolitical tensions, specifically leaders in the U.S. and China. But Neil Shearing at Capital Economics in London says it's not just the tit-for-tat tariffs causing problems.
I think the biggest damage that's caused by the trade war is not the direct effect of tariffs themselves, but more the indirect effect of tariffs and the effect it has on business confidence and the knock-on effect on business investment in particular.
And Murray Gold at the market forecasting firm Elliott Wave International says he'd be surprised if global growth even managed to hit the IMF's recently revised figure of 3%.
Although the headlines seem quite pessimistic in this report, the IMF are normally always over-optimistic.
He says on top of the U.S. and China trade war, the economic slowdown in Germany, along with concerns about a no-deal Brexit, could cause even more problems. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Now for a different look at China's economy with more math. Consumer inflation in China was up 3% last month, a six-year high, in part because pork prices shot up almost 70%. For more, I'm joined by Marketplace's China correspondent, Jennifer Pak, in Shanghai. Jennifer, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit more about the situation on the ground and specifically about pork and the inflation in food prices.
Right. Well, inflation has gone up so high because pork is a staple in the Chinese diet. So even things that you don't think contains pork, it's not in the name at all, it's in it. So prices went up because of something called the African swine fever. It's devastated the pig population, and so prices have gone up. The other thing that's also gone up is fruit prices, which in the last few months have gone up in the double digits as well because of bad weather. So all of these things compounded has pushed the inflation prices up.
And how are you experiencing it? How are people on the ground really feeling right now? What does it look like in the grocery store?
Well, of course, the pork stalls, you know, everyone when I go to my local meat and veggie market, they're kind of a bit sad looking. You know, they say people aren't buying as much, that they're really suffering. A lot of people are trying really hard not to raise the prices too high because they want customers to come back. But on a day-to-day basis, I think people are maybe able to cut back a bit. Because remember, there are people over the age of 50 or 60, they tell me that they only had meat maybe once or twice a year. So for people to cut back, I'm not saying it's not going to be painful, but some people are perhaps buying less. We're not saying that they're completely cutting meat out entirely.
Is there a clear sense that this is related to the trade war in any way, or are people mostly blaming the swine flu for these shortages?
Well, of course, in the local media, which is heavily censored, it's mainly about the African swine fever. So people on the street, they know that the economy is slowing down. They're worried about it, but they don't really know exactly why, when it's going to happen. So everyone's just trying to make sure that they could cover the basics. And don't forget, it's not just food prices that are going up. Housing prices are still going up. Also, education, healthcare, people have to take care of their elderly parents. Those things weigh on people a lot more than the trade tensions with the U.S.
For all our differences, some things are the same. Presumably, to sort of bring it around to the U.S., presumably this pork shortage in particular is good for U.S. pork producers to fill some of that shortage, right? Is there any sense that some of this gap could be made up by importing from the United States?
Yeah, I mean, there obviously this is the prime time for U.S. pork producers to jump right in, right? 40% decline in the pig population, it's perfect. Unfortunately, they're not benefiting as much as other countries would be selling pork to China because of something called the tariff war. So they have an extra 50% tariff on their pork. But in terms of satisfying China's demand, you have to understand that imports account for a very tiny portion of the pork consumed in China. 95% of the pork consumed in China is produced right here.
Jennifer Pack is Marketplace's China correspondent. Jennifer, thanks so much for staying up late.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
On Wall Street today, thank goodness for earnings season to bring back the green. Details and math when we do the numbers. Now back to a story we had on the show yesterday about Euler School in Cincinnati, Ohio. Our senior correspondent, Amy Scott, has been following Euler for more than 7 years as its leaders and staff have tried to turn around not just a struggling school, but also the distressed neighborhood surrounding it. Amy told us yesterday that effort now includes a $34 million plan to rehab buildings and bring more affordable housing to the community. But just fixing up buildings is only part of the solution. People gotta have jobs too. Here's Amy Scott.
Gabrielle Duncan slips on a hairnet and safety glasses and steps onto a factory floor where workers are busy filling bottles of Downy wrinkle releaser and packaging boogie wipes, you know, for snotty toddlers. She takes her post at a heat sealing machine, pumping a foot pedal to close up trial packs of Pampers.
So it's got 2 diapers in it, 1 thing of wipes, and a coupon.
Gabby's a line captain at Nehemiah Manufacturing in Cincinnati's Lower Price Hill. It's known as a second chance employer with a mission to hire people who often struggle to find jobs because of addiction, mental health issues, or criminal records. We sit down to talk during a break.
I don't have a record, but being down here, almost everybody you know has a record. So I'm all for it. Because I've personally seen people change. I know people can change. They just got to work for it.
Instead of a traditional HR department, Nehemiah has 3 social workers on staff who help with transportation, housing, and childcare. They're helping Gabby find her first apartment. Company leaders say the extra cost pays off in lower turnover. Gabby went to Euler from 9th to 11th grade. She dropped out after getting pregnant.
And right around the time that I was allowed to work after having my baby, EMI opened up. So I ventured this way because I live right up the street.
And that is the goal of a major effort to bring jobs back to Lower Price Hill. The neighborhood was once known for its heavy industry, which created a lot of pollution, but also steady employment for people in the community.
Through disinvestment throughout the decades, the 80s weren't really kind to any urban area. I lost a lot of business.
That's Adeline Hall with the Community Learning Center Institute, which oversees the health and social services at Euler School. She was brought on 4 years ago to help solve a housing crisis in the neighborhood. The school was losing families to eviction, and more kids were at risk of homelessness. She says the cost of the housing isn't the problem. A typical apartment rents for around $700.
If you look at the prices, you think, okay, that's pretty affordable. What we're having is an income issue.
The median income is under $15,000, and the unemployment rate is more than 20%.
So what we have also worked on simultaneously around housing is employment and bringing in businesses that make a commitment to hire residents.
Nehemiah Manufacturing was a big win. The company opened its 180,000-square-foot facility last year on a notorious brownfield where a toxic barrel cleaning plant burned to the ground 15 years ago. So far, Nehemiah's hired more than 70 people from the neighborhood. McAndrews Windows and Glass is another new employer. Troy McAndrews is president.
About 10 years ago, we replaced the windows at the Euler School, and we could tell at that point in time how bad the neighborhood was, but you could see it starting to slowly improve.
The company relocated to Lower Price Hill back in March, drawn by the quick access to highways and downtown. Four of its 40 workers are locals, including Derek Hope, who's measuring lengths of metal to cut for a window frame.
It's convenient because I live across the street, so that's kind of like a win-win for me.
One thing Lower Price Hill has going for it is its history. Much of the housing is ornate brick Italianate architecture from the late 1800s. Steve Smith saw the charm when he started investing in the neighborhood in the 1990s. He's CEO of the Model Group, an affordable housing developer. He says he made a mistake when he developed his first project here.
When we bought the buildings, they had apartments all the way down to the first floor along State Street, which is the commercial corridor. All of those storefronts along State Street were bricked in, and we left them bricked in. We didn't know.
Now they know. It takes more than affordable housing to improve a neighborhood. So the plan is to renovate his company's Section 8 housing and add retail shops along that business corridor. A new nonprofit grocery store will open soon down the street.
The neighborhood is like an ecosystem. You need places for people to live. You also need places for people to work and play. You need a mix of incomes in a neighborhood.
In the last decade, Steve's company has helped transform another nearby neighborhood where houses like the ones in Lower Price Hill now sell for more than $500,000. To avoid displacing current residents, he says, the key is to preserve affordable housing before a neighborhood gets trendy.
There's so many vacant buildings. There's room for everyone. We can do addition without subtraction.
And Lower Price Hill is still a long way from trendy. Adeline Hall says a lot of the funding for all this development still has to be raised.
We have the committed partners in the right places. Some are farther along than others in having the dollars needed to get hammers swinging. But hopefully in the next 2 to 3 years, you'll really see a transformation in the neighborhood.
And typical Euler style, she says they'll keep working on it until it's done. In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We've got all Amy's stories about Euler School, along with some pictures of the neighborhood at marketplace.org. Coming up,
it virtually lasts forever. It does not break down.
The legal fight over a chemical that's polluted the whole world. But first, let's do the numbers. Some strong quarterly earnings reports helped boost the markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 237 points. Here's the math part, nearly 0.9% to close at 27,024. I'm done now. The NASDAQ rose 100 points, nearly 1.25% to finish at 8148. And the S&P 500 advanced 29 points, just under 1%, to end at 29.95. It was a mixed day for the big banks on that earnings front. Goldman Sachs, the most interesting, reported its quarterly profits fell below analyst expectations, thanks in part to losses on its stake in companies like Uber and, oh boy, WeWork. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.77%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Walmart rolled out a new service today in three markets. If you live in Kansas City, Pittsburgh, or Vero Beach, Florida, Walmart will deliver groceries directly to your fridge. Amazon launched a similar service last year. So are you willing to let a stranger root around in your kitchen in exchange for, you know, doing zero work yourself? As Marketplace's Mariel Segura reports, apparently.
If you sign up for this service, it's not like you hand over a key to Walmart. You install a smart lock on your front door, and then the people delivering your groceries get into your house with a one-time code. They'll wear cameras that live stream the whole thing. And you can watch on your smartphone if you have the time or inclination. But you're still agreeing to let a stranger into your house when you're not home. David Schweidel is a marketing professor at Emory University.
It's a trade-off, right? I want the increased convenience, and so I have to be willing to give up some of my privacy.
Entire businesses are based on this exchange. You get to use services, which maybe make your life a little easier, and they get to collect your personal data.
If I want to use Uber, I have to be comfortable trading data about the places that I go to. Each consumer is going to make that decision themselves of how much do I value the convenience that this service affords me versus how important is privacy to me.
Walmart could have an advantage because it's one of the first in the marketplace. Matt Hamery is a managing director at Alex Partners.
If you have this in your house and Walmart's in there, are you going to also want to let six other retailers in there, or would you rather stick with Walmart because they've already done it well and you're happy to buy the things from them?
Hamery says if Walmart can get people to trust this service, it could move beyond product delivery. He imagines a world in which you buy a TV from Walmart and the company sends someone to install it when you're not home, as long as you don't mind them seeing your kid's softball schedule on the fridge. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
You know that great thing where you find $20 in your jacket pocket, or there's money in Venmo that you didn't realize was there? Let's do you one better. North Carolina resident Gracelyn Hyman found out her dad had put money into a malpractice insurance pool decades ago, and she was entitled to refunds, big ones.
It turned out that there were basically refunds for several different years, and some of those refunds were twice in 1 year. And I started adding it up, and it would be a couple of thousand for this payout, you know, and 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 for that payout. And when I added them all up, it came to over $13,000.
States are sitting on billions of dollars in what is known as unclaimed property. And just like Gracelyn Hyman, some of that money could belong to you. We have tips on how you can find out if you have any lost money. Check it out at marketplace.org. Teflon used to be a must-have in every kitchen, but making Teflon involved a dangerous chemical called PFOA, among other names. Over the last two decades, Teflon maker DuPont has been sued several times over this chemical. Workers at DuPont factories got sick from it. It leaked into the water supply in several West Virginia communities and caused illnesses and cancer. In 2017, DuPont paid $671 million to settle over 3,500 personal injury lawsuits related to PFOA. Robert Ballot is an environmental lawyer based in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he was the lead attorney in the earliest court cases against DuPont. His book about it is called Exposure: Poisoned Water, Corporate Greed, and One Lawyer's 20-Year Battle Against DuPont. Robert, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us, these chemicals go by lots of different names in your book. Tell us what they are and why they're so bad.
Yeah, you know, the main chemical that I talk about in the book is called PFOA, and it's a completely man-made synthetic chemical. And when it gets out into the environment, it virtually lasts forever. It does not break down under natural conditions. And you may hear this referred to in the whole family of chemicals referred to now as forever chemicals because of that.
Right. I mean, the scale of that pollution is astonishing. You say in the book that they have essentially polluted the entire world.
That's right. We're talking about a chemical that has basically gotten into the blood of virtually every living thing on the planet. I think it's been estimated to be in the blood of about 99% of humans in the United States. You know, and unfortunately, just about all of it that's been emitted out into the environment since the early 1950s is still out there until we actually go and somehow remove it.
So let's go back to the beginning of the book and how this 20-year journey got started with a call from a farmer who was recommended by your grandmother at a time when you were a corporate environmental defense lawyer. How did Earl Tennant, the farmer, win you onto this case?
Well, as you indicated, one day I got a call from this individual out in West Virginia, Mr. Tennant, telling me about his cows dying. Found out he had over 100 animals that had died on his property. He thought it was all related to some sort of white foaming water coming out of a landfill owned by DuPont. So I invited him to come up to our offices, and he brought VHS tapes, photographs. We took a look at what he had, and what we saw was pretty disturbing. We could see tumors on the animals. We could see blackened teeth. And we thought, gee, this is something we should be able to help him with.
Now, Earl Tennant's case and all the cases that came after really did hinge on this information that only DuPont knew. You know, what this chemical was, whether it might be toxic, how much, if so. How did you then, this book is really about this journey of, not to make a legal pun, discovery.
Right.
Getting all that information and finding it out, right?
Absolutely. You know, when we first jumped into the case, we thought this was going to be fairly straightforward. We could pull the permits and check the list of all the regulated contaminants in the landfill, and surely we'd find something that was listed there that was maybe too high, too much of it in the water. But what we found out is when we started looking into it, we really couldn't find anything on the list of the regulated materials in this landfill. And we started digging into more and more documents. We had to go to court to get DuPont to turn over its files. And one day I stumbled upon a document that mentioned this chemical PFOA. The company had been studying its effects, all kinds of studies on the toxicity of the chemical, its ability to cause cancer. But what was particularly disturbing is when we found out that it had also been found in the local public water supply and that tens of thousands of people were likely drinking it, but nobody had been told, and the government agencies hadn't been told because it was unregulated.
And what has been DuPont's position throughout?
I think it's been fairly consistent that there is simply inadequate evidence that PFOA actually causes any harm to humans. But through the work of this community out in West Virginia and Ohio, setting up these massive human health studies, we were able to independently confirm that drinking this chemical is, in fact, linked with 6 different diseases, including 2 types of cancer.
And that was a very remarkable development. You call it the big idea after this settlement of a class action lawsuit in 2004. The individual plaintiffs did not take payouts. Instead, they used this money to help fund this ambitious series of studies. Tell us about that and whether there was any precedent for it.
You know, when we sat down with DuPont and reached a settlement of the community's class claims, the people in that community wanted independent scientific confirmation of what will this do to us in the long term. And at that point in time, DuPont was still arguing that there simply was no evidence sufficient to show what this chemical would do to people drinking it. So when DuPont turned over a pot of money at the end of the case, we decided to use that money and actually fill in the missing data gap. We would pay people in the class to come in, have their blood drawn, sampled for the chemical, provide medical information, and then finally have a big enough sample size and enough data to turn over to these independent scientists to confirm once and for all that, yes, these health effects are in fact happening in this community. And nobody had really done that before. Well, we really didn't have a model to work from. So we weren't sure, how successful it would be. But we ended up getting 69,000 people out of the estimated 70,000 in the community to participate, and ended up being one of the biggest studies ever done, 12 different epidemiology studies spanning over 7 years. And at the end of the day, again, they were able to confirm drinking it was linked with 6 diseases, including 2 types of cancer.
Robert Bullaugh is an environmental lawyer based in Cincinnati, Ohio. His book is called Exposure, Poisoned Water, Corporate Greed, and One Lawyer's 20-Year Battle Against DuPont. Robert, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This story is pretty crazy. You can read the first chapter of that book at our website, marketplace.org. And the story is also the subject of a movie coming out this fall called Dark Waters. This final note on the way out. Yes, I know I need to watch Succession. It's on my list. But Succession also sparked a good piece in the Financial Times about the dangers of inherited wealth. It can, of course, cause HBO-worthy family drama, but also research from a wealth consultancy group called the Williams Group finds that by the 3rd generation, most inherited family wealth is 90% gone. And that's it for us today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 237 points. That's nearly 0.9%. The NASDAQ rose 100 points, nearly 1.25%. And the S&P 500 advanced 29 points, just under 1% on that index. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Joanne Griffith, Ben Heathcote, and Sarah Menendez. Satara Nieves is our Executive Director of On Demand. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.